Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. And we are back with South America, the city's version. As I like to introduce it, series one, part two, episode 13 of 14. Maybe, no, 14 of 14, could be 14 of 15. Who knows where we are and where we'll end up. Actually, one man who does know where we are, first of all, is the series creator from about 6 years ago when we first had the idea of this series, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome. Where are we?
Well, thanks, Stu. Yeah, we've popped on a plane. We've flown around 430 miles or so from Rosario across the Andes and landed at the Comodoro Arturo Mariño Benitez International Airport in a city with a population of around 7 million, which equates to approximately 40% for the total number of people living in the country. The city was founded in 1541 by the Spanish conquistador Pedro de Valdivia. It has a downtown core of 19th century neoclassic architecture and winding side streets featuring a mix of Art Deco, Neo-Gothic and other styles. Its cityscape is defined by several standalone hills and the fast-flowing Mapocho River, which is lined by parks such as the Parque Forestal and the Balmaceda Park. The Andes Mountains can be seen from most parts of the city and contribute to a smog problem, particularly during the winter, due to the lack of rain. The outskirts of the city are surrounded by vineyards, and it's within an hour's drive of both the mountains and the Pacific Ocean. We're in the birthplace of Arturo Vidal, Ivan Zamorano, Manuel Pellegrini, and the ex-president Salvador Allende. We're in Santiago, the capital of Chile. How about that, bro?
Yeah, excellent. And for those of you who are listening, I can reassure it was Gary Thacker and not Alan Wicker who did our our introduction for this episode.
More like Alan Thicker, more like.
And over to our first co-host, Judith Chalmers. No, not Judith Chalmers. Our first co-host, Mr. Stephen Scribe. Stephen, welcome to Wish You Were Here.
I'm just glad you didn't say Frank Boff then. A bit of holiday 87 and whatever goes on in his spare room.
Oh, I can't believe this is the level we're at. We're only about 3 minutes in. I would say, are you looking forward to this episode?
Very much so. Very much so. Surprise episode in many respects.
For who?
For the curator more than anyone else, and then probably me in a kind of like a narrow second place there.
Well, we'll come to our final co-host, who we've actually had to tear away from the World Championship ice hockey. So, really, I'm not going to say this has been the best planned episode, but we'll see how. Well, to be fair, I'm not sure.
It will be seamless, absolutely seamless.
Once it's edited, no one will ever know any of this happened. Pete, welcome to the podcast. How's the ice hockey going?
I mean, last time I looked, it was Switzerland 2, Slovakia 1. And the big news was that Slovakia had scored the first goal against Switzerland in the entire World Championships, with Switzerland having nearly broken the third most ever, preserving their net intact in the World Cup history. So it was a big game to have to break away from. But, you know, it's Santiago, so I felt I had to.
So in this sort of hybrid episode of Wish You Were Here / Trans World Sport, we'll ask you, Pete, really, just to bring a bit of sense and sensibility, might as well throw in a literature quote in there as well, some sense and sensibility to this episode. So, as we said, Santiago, obviously the airport was named after Rafa Benitez's dad. So we know where we are. We know where we've arrived at. If you could just tell us a little bit about the clubs and the history of Santiago.
Okay, so this is probably one of those that I end up with a lot of information about, mostly because I used to live there way back in the day, and my kind of year out from university. So I've got an attachment to the city anyway. Coached at the Grange School, bit of football, bit of rugby, Chilean international cricketer. So got a lot of affinity with the city. But basically, Santiago, you're going back to kind of more or less the 1880s for the foundation of the first kind of sporting and football clubs in the city. The original kind of big derby was actually with Valparaiso, the kind of the port city. Santiago is a bit further inland. So the first kind of footballing contests are largely between Valparaiso, which starts it off, and then Santiago, which is inspired by the Valparaiso example. So what you have really is various types of football clubs that emerge from different origins. You have kind of the clubs that emerge from schools and educational establishments. You have clubs that kind of emerge from the barrios, the various kind of different parts of the city. They're often inspired by the kind of the elite schools that are starting to play. And then you have a lot of kind of factory teams as well. And actually, there's been a lot of great writing about this. Brenda Elsie has written a great book about a lot of the factory teams and working class barrio kind of teams, which exist and which we often don't really talk about. But they're all in their kind of own private factory amateur leagues. Well, let's deal with the big clubs. The first really big club is Colo Colo. It's named after a kind of Mapuche indigenous tribe leader from the colonization period. They were actually formed by an offshoot by players who left another big club, Magallanes, who were known as the first big club. They were a team that won the first three editions of the professional league in 1933, 1934, and 1935. Colo Colo was a split off from that particular team. We'll talk about the guy that really gave rise to them later on as being probably one of the greatest figures of Chilean football. But Colo Colo are very important there. They're the only team that's never been relegated in the Premier League, the Chilean First Division. They're the first Chilean team to get to the Libertadores final. They've had some really kind of strong periods throughout history and have always been seen as the club that represents Chile. Then we have two university teams. We have Universidad Católica, the Catholic University, and we have Universidad de Chile. Again, they're both, as they said, formed from the origins of university teams, of students who used to play often for different faculties, and then through various different incarnations and mergers with other faculty teams or other kind of student groups that were playing at the university, came to represent the universities themselves. They've largely kind of diverged from being just a university team to get much more wider public following, but they still obviously have these historic associations with those two main universities in Santiago. Then we've got, I suppose, what we could call the diaspora teams. There's three of these, really. We have Unión Española, which represent the kind of the Spanish migrants that moved to Santiago in the kind of late 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. We have Audax Italiano, which, as the name would suggest, represent the Italian diaspora. They originally founded as a cycling club back in 1910, but eventually in 1917, the football section kind of began and grew and became even more popular, and became one of the most successful teams in the early years of the kind of professional era. And then the other big kind of diaspora club, and probably one of the most famous political teams of the world, is Palestino. Again, as the name suggests, they represent the Palestine diaspora. They actually started as mainly a tennis club, but after playing in a kind of Olympiad for Palestine migrants in Chile in the city of Osorno back in the 1950s, they kind of became more and more serious about playing football, and have got very close links with Palestine and the Palestinians throughout the world, to the extent that a lot of their matches are actually televised on Al Jazeera for people living in Palestine. Then I guess we've got some other kind of hot old historic clubs that still exist. We have the brilliantly named Santiago Morning, first founded in 1903 as the Instituto Comercial Football Club, then became Santiago Football Club, briefly Brazil Football Club, and then Small Chile Football Club. Again, that's not a name that particularly would have gone particularly well. They eventually merged to become Morning Star, and then eventually their name changed again through to Santiago Morning. So a club that struggled with its identity for many years. They also are known as the Microbuseros, i.e. the microbuses, because for a period of time, their president was the head of the Metropolitan Bus Association. Probably makes it easy to get on away trips for them when they're traveling around the country. Who else have we got? Magallanes is one of the famous clubs. Again, we already mentioned them as being the club that Colo Colo emerged from. They were, again, one of the big early clubs. They were originally a club that emerged from a school called the Escuela Normal. They were formed by basically teachers and students who were learning to be teachers. It was a school that was very interested in modernization in teaching in education, the importance of education for Chile. So a lot of the people that came out of that particular school were people who were interested in training sport in physical education. And it was only natural, probably, that they formed one of the first football teams. But again, a lot of the students there were from elite members of the society. So they kind of had the reputation of being very much an elite club. Then we can go down to, I suppose, the little clubs that still exist, that have kind of bobbed around the second and third division. We've got clubs like Deportes Recoleta, Athletic Club Barnechea, who were known as the Huaycocheros, which immediately I just had to bring because it's a great nickname. We have Real San Joaquin, who play at a stadium called the Estadio Arturo Vidal, named after one of Chile's greatest ever football players. And then the other historic club that's still around are a club called Ferroviarios de Chile, a railway club founded in 1916, did merge at one point with the badminton club to have a team called Ferro Badminton, i.e. Iron Badminton. The only reason they actually merged was because badminton was supposed to be relegated. They refused to be relegated as one of the original members of the Football League. Ferroviarios were due to be promoted, refused to not accept not being promoted. So the only logical conclusion was the clubs to merge to become Ferro Badminton, i.e. Iron Badminton. Sadly, that didn't last and they split. But Ferroviarios, despite a TV program called Ferro de Corazón back in 2009, which was trying to get them back up the leagues there to their kind of much desired place, are still lurking in the kind of fifth division, more or less, of Chilean football. And then finally, we've got various teams that haven't made it through history. Santiago Nacional Football Club, founded in 1900, sadly disappeared in 1955. Again, one of the main amateur teams. Atletico Union, again, one of the major teams, went out of existence in 1906 after one bad season, showing a lack of stickability. Sadly, Thunder Football Club didn't make it any further than 1907. And Loma Blanca, Deutsche Sportverein and Gymnastico Arturo Prat were other clubs that started, made it through a few of the amateur years, but didn't go any further. Liverpool Wanderers did exist for a while in the kind of municipality of Recoleta, another Liverpool team. And then there was one club called Deportes Pindana, who seemed to be a club that almost everyone seemed to beat in their first game for some reason. Again, dissolved in 2014. So, that pretty much sums up, you know, the kind of the clubs, the runners and riders of Santiago.
Wow. I mean, to be fair, Pete, by episode 14, you should have got your act together. So well done on finally getting sorted and knowing what you're talking about. Just brilliant as always. Absolutely brilliant. Although you had me at Iron Badminton. I'm all over. I'm all over a game of Iron Badminton. Gary, I think technically this was the last episode of this series. And surely this has got to be the most South American city backdrop to end all South American city backdrops for football.
I mean, actually, the one that we scheduled to be the last one is the one we're going to be doing next week. We sort of jammed this one in because Pete said about this the clubs there. We thought, like, got to do it because you say it. Can you have a more South American club landscape than the one Pete just described? And, you know, when he said Santiago, and I looked up the research a few days ago, and the only club I recognised was Colo-Colo. I mean, it's one of those things, you know, you want to say it's Coca-Cola, it's not, but it's Coca-Cola, and it's one of those sort of teams. The depth of clubs, I mean, I found the two university clubs and Santiago Morning, as Pete mentioned, but, you know, the depth of knowledge Pete has of these sort of things just blows my brains away. I mean, it's just brilliant, but yeah, it's just typical of the sort of short-lived clubs, the clubs that are so successful. There just never seems to be any sort of middle ground. There's these teams that are massively successful, the teams that sort of they're there one day and gone tomorrow. I mean, Santiago Morning, it's like Sheffield Wednesday, isn't it? You know, but they haven't gone on it by the afternoon, apparently. They're still there.
I feel like stability would be the enemy of this podcast.
Oh, definitely, brother.
Stephen, again, another great story. One team refuses to be relegated. One team won't accept that they can't get promoted, so let's just merge. Stuff like that just doesn't happen, but clearly it does, and we love it.
Well, this is what we love about the South American game, though, isn't it? All the type of things, we've said it before, all the type of things that shouldn't be allowed in British football is, you know, it has to happen in South America, and we'd be disappointed if it didn't.
Yeah, South American football has so much, like you say, I think probably we started off one of the first couple of episodes with this, in that I think we're happy that we can watch it from a distance, but would be very fearful if this was the landscape of British football.
I think having a vested interest in this would be absolutely horrendous. unless you're just a Glory supporter and following one of the big ones that are just never going to disappear. But having your team kind of like, you know, drift into it, I mean, the closest we have is kind of like non-league football where, you know, Russian, there's something like Russian Diamonds can happen, you know, and all that type of stuff. You know, Dagenham and Redbridge sewn together. You know, it's like the, you know, the two ends of one, you know, the back end of a car being welded to the front end of a car. It's all very 1982 in that respect. You know, it's kind of all right if it's kind of like non-league and it's happening down in the eighth and ninth level. No, don't get too close. You know, that's fine. You know, but yeah, South America, just go for it. Whatever you want to do, you go for it. It's you know, we love you for it. I mean, Santiago morning. You know, it's great. It's just for morning people. You know, if you're getting up after midday, then you know, sorry, you can't come and watch us.
That's why the students had to set up their own teams. The students
have got no chance whatsoever.
Absolutely not. Needed a different market. Pete, just a quick question on that. I suppose, conversely, obviously you haven't lived in South America. Do South American cities, whatever you want to look at it, whatever lens you want to look at it through, do they cast envious eyes on the relative stability of clubs in Europe? Or are they very proud of the volatility that they have?
I think there are two things here. I think that what you kind of have in South America is it's kind of like an obsession with big club football. And that's really what matters a lot of the time. I think that in some countries you have a certain amount of more established identities of clubs that really exist and will always exist. I think you look at Argentina as being a prime example of that. And you know, but I think that the kind of the second, third division become very precarious. You know, you don't often get that much attention in the national news and newspapers. There isn't, you know, a lot of the time that kind of cult tradition of supporting the small team. I think it's growing. I think it's more there. I think that that's increasingly a reaction to, you know, the kind of the coming and going of the big players that will, you know, will start, will do very well, and then will disappear to go to Europe. So almost you want to be somewhere where the kind of there is a little bit more of a, I don't know, maybe a kind of it's not quite as consumed by world football as much. So there is a kind of attraction about these smaller teams, but it's not established in the whole of the continent. Certainly Colombia, you don't have as much of a pride in the smaller team. You know, they come and go very quickly and the second division is almost invisible. So I think that's a problem. But I think that, you know, I don't think they will look with great, you know, I suppose, envy at the stability necessarily of European football. Because I don't think for a longer time that was really of interest. You know, why would they care if Rotherham have existed for 40 years? You know, I don't think it'll, you know, 120 years or whatever it is for Rotherham. I don't think that really matters. So I think that they're very proud of the type of football they have. And again, I think you have to look at a lot of these clubs when they first start anyway are kind of student teams. They're kids formed by kids who are enthralled by the prospect of playing football, this kind of new, exciting thing, and they want to set it up and it's a chance to be modern. It's a chance to play together. So it's very exciting. And it's just the way things go that these clubs don't always make it. What I find amazing is that there are records of them. And I think it's great. And there's lots of amazing historians. You know, I read a lot of great work by Diego Vilches and Brenda Elsie and Pedro Acuña and various other Chilean academics who've rescued these teams from being forgotten, who have written stories about the football teams of the factories or the neighbourhood teams who existed and stood for something and brought the neighbourhood together and maybe support and maybe occupied a lot of the clubs. One of the interesting things about these clubs, some of these clubs, is that they kind of were squatting. They occupied kind of land to play football. And that was seen as an active possession for the community. So I think what's amazing is that Chilean historians predominantly and Brenda Elsie is American, have rescued these stories to say these people existed. These were issues. These were communities. And I think that's incredibly valuable. The fact they don't exist anymore is a shame. But they were there, they had an impact. And there are newspapers that report their games. And in that little way, they're kind of immortal. Maybe only be found in an archive somewhere. But for a historian like me, that's just an amazing thing. I mean, I love it.
Gary, I think before we go on to the next bit, I think, you know, and again, we talk about it quite a bit, but that conservation of social history, because it is. Yes, it's about football teams and what have you, but like Peter just said there, it's also about so much more in terms of the people, communities, what they stood for, what was happening culturally, politically at that time when they were in existence?
Yeah, it's interesting that two of the three biggest teams that Pete's mentioned there both come from universities, like, you know, Club Deportivo Universidad Catalitica and Club Universidad de Chile. They came from student teams. I think that's the first time we've had in any of the cities we've looked at. I mean, there have been university teams in the past, but two of the biggest three clubs in that city. Now, that's probably, I say it's unique. I mean, it feels like it's unique considering the cities we've looked at. And, you know, I guess it's that sort of, there's different ways, there's different reasons why clubs are formed. And students in from universities seems to be a common thing. But to have two clubs seems to be, you know, particularly significant in Santiago. I think that's true, Pete.
Yeah, I think I was just trying to think about the other ones. Peru has a big university team, Universitario, but there aren't too many that will have two. A lot of them will have a lot of teams that were linked to schools or universities or colleges. I think what's really interesting in the Chilean case is that there's kind of a boom in education that comes from the fact that Chile win the War of the Pacific. They get suddenly a lot of more access to things like nitrates from the Atacama Desert. Or that particular type of region, they suddenly their economy really booms. And there's also this real interest in trying to educate the nation and build better and more intelligent Chileans. So a lot of the money of various presidencies goes towards forming these educational institutions. And part of the curriculum becomes physical education. And part of physical education is playing different types of sport, and football becomes one of the main ones. So because kind of Chile win a War of the Pacific and then they win all these nitrates and all these other things, they really do get the chance to invest in these kind of educational and sporting opportunities that leads to this kind of boom in all these clubs developing. You know, and again, a lot of the other clubs that don't make it start in schools. You know, that's kind of one of the major starting points for it. And again, a lot of the development that also is happening because of that War of the Pacific and earning these kind of, you know, economic facilities, also starts to help their industrialization. So a lot of the kind of workplace factory football, which is also very prevalent, is also based on that. So, you know, you have all these kind of interconnected features that arise from it. And school institutions is one of the main ones.
Yeah, it's interesting. I looked at the Club Deportivo Universidad Catalitica. They got to the Copa Libertadores final in 93 before losing. And they also got to four semifinals. So I mean, that's pretty successful, and Club Universidad de Chile won the Copa Sudamerica in 2011 as well. So I mean, they're not only fairly successful in Chile, but also of continental success as well.
It's why I love doing this series. The stories, you know, like you say, the stories not so well known, but certainly of the bigger clubs, and then you have it's what lies underneath, I think, that makes. Or certainly, I think makes this episode, this series, so rich. Political affiliations, then, Pete, is always the next thing. Where people's affiliations lie, where clubs align themselves with or to, or if they remain independent. Again, another overview from you, please, because you'll know more than anyone else.
Yeah, there's so much here, so I'll try and keep it relatively brief. I think one of the most interesting things about Chilean football is a lot of the ways in which General Augusto Pinochet, the impact that he had on Chilean football and the way in which clubs were kind of related to him. So Pinochet was a dictator that took over power in a coup in 1973, deposing kind of Chile, one of the continent's first, you know, left-wing elected socialist presidents in Salvador Allende. And again, when we get to kind of important matches, I'm going to talk about that in a little bit more detail. There's a really interesting story there. But basically what you end up having is Colo-Colo seeming to be appropriated by Pinochet as his club. He becomes its honorary president. He manipulates it in lots of ways. You know, they become the team that is put on telly whenever there are the risk of public protest against his particular regime. Suddenly there is a match from Colo-Colo that is put on TV. But it's important to realize that this was not that this is not a rare thing. You know, Colo-Colo have been largely vilified for links with Pinochet. You used to apparently see Colo-Colo flags in pro-Pinochet protests, but also Colo-Colo fans were very visible when the Iva Caer and He Is Going to Fall protest started to happen in the late 1980s. You know, you see banners going up in Colo-Colo grounds and chants against Colo-Colo, against Pinochet there as well. But Colo-Colo have always been a team that's been completely appropriated by different presidents at different times. I mean, there's one period back in, I think it's the 1920s or 1930s, I think it's the late 1920s, when there is a match that's been played against a Peruvian team in order to try and improve relationships between Peru and Chile, based around the fact that it was the 50th year of the anniversary of the War of the Pacific, when Chile basically earns a lot of Peruvian and Bolivian territory. So there's always been this rivalry between Peru and Chile because of this. And there's a match played around about the 50th year anniversary of this to try and improve relationships. And Colo-Colo were chosen by the Chilean government to be the team that represents Chile in this match because they are seen as being the most Chilean of the teams. And this is down to lots of reasons. They're kind of seen as being a team that's created around national ideas, that they are based on Chileanness. And the reason for that is that because of their name, Colo-Colo, which again links back to this kind of Mapuche linkage, they're somehow seen as being Chilean. And again, Diego Vilches is really brilliant on this. And he says it's almost a kind of a fake identity. There's no kind of appreciation of the indigenousness of what they actually were. You know, the Mapuche indigenous groups and other indigenous tribes in Chile at the time are largely marginalized. They're hugely discriminated against. They're almost invisible because they represent backwardness and lack of civilization and barbarity. So they don't resonate with this idea of a Chilean modern identity, which has been promoted in the 1920s. What they do represent, however, is Chileanness in the fact that these were people who fought against the Spanish. And also, a lot of the teams that were existing at the time in Chile were more associated with European values. They were looking forward to Europe to be modern, to be like the Europeans. So Magallanes are based around elites that want to be European. Audax Italiano are a club of Italian migrants. Unión Española are a team of Spanish migrants. So Colo-Colo, by taking on the name Colo-Colo, suddenly become Chilean. It's kind of a demonstration of middle-class Chileans say, we're not wanting to be European, we want to be Chilean. But the name is taken to try and be Chilean, but again, it's almost, like I say, it doesn't really relate to the existence of the Mapuche in Chile at the time. It's just they kind of imagine what these Chilean Indians were like, brave and courageous and everything else, but it has no representation of reality. And there's some great writing by Diego Vilches on this. I think what's also interesting about Colo-Colo is that everyone talks about how Pinochet appropriated them, but Salvador Allende did exactly the same thing. You know, he is basically trying to gain popularity during his regime by inviting Colo-Colo players to the president palace when they're doing well in the 1973 Copa Libertadores. He's been seen taking photos of all of them. So the same kind of things that Pinochet was doing by trying to associate with the club of the people has been done throughout history by Pedro Ibáñez, by Allende, by various other presidents as well. So that's kind of like a really interesting thing about Colo-Colo, I guess. The other teams, like I said, I think Palestina are the most interesting of all the other ones because of those links with Palestine. I've already said that a lot of their TV game, their games are televised in Al Jazeera and transported to and are televised in Palestine. Whenever they do well, Palestinians in Palestine will be supporting them. They're seen as almost the second team to the Palestinian national team, such as it is when it exists. In fact, some of the Chilean players of Palestina who have got Palestinian ancestors have played for Palestine national team as well. The most famous story about Palestina was, I think, in 2014, when on their shirt they had basically every player had number one on his shirt was shaped in the shape of the historic Palestine land territory, what should have been historically Palestine. And you can imagine this caused a huge amount of controversy with Jewish communities in Chile. There were a lot of complaints about it. It became a really big issue. They were obviously banned from using it eventually. But of course, that meant it became the most famous and probably most well-sold shirt in, I guess, you know, Palestinian history. Certainly, it's one of those kind of collectible shirts that everyone wants. And again, yeah, I guess the other interesting kind of story, we've already kind of talked about Audax Italiano, Unión Española, with very evident links to Spain and Italy. One of the problems that they had was during the kind of the period of fascism and the Spanish Civil War and World War II was that this created divisions in the migrant communities in Chile of Italians and Spaniards who fell on different sides of the political divide. You know, you can imagine the Unión Española families and clubs thinking, you know, are we Republican? Are we nationalists? you know, what we tied to. So that created a schism within the club. Same thing for those who maybe supported Mussolini and those who didn't, for Audax Italiano. There was one point actually where I think Unión Española couldn't play in the Chilean league because there was so many kind of so much dissent going on. So that's a kind of very key identity construct. But both clubs have tried to make an attempt to become more Chilean, to kind of remove the sense of Spanishness or Italianness. They're still there. They're still present in what they do and what they wear in the badges, but they're still Chilean teams. And the last team I want to talk about is Santiago Morning, who used to be very popular with the kind of intellectuals, the poets, the artists, the musicians. They were the club of the Bohemios back in the 1930s and 1940s. So there were quite a few poets and kind of songwriters that wrote songs about Santiago Morning in that kind of period when they were doing well. But eventually these kind of intellectuals and artists got bored by the fact they weren't winning, much like any other kind of glory hunting fan, and kind of disappeared. So that kind of identity has disappeared a little bit.
The more I hear about that club, the more I love them. Gary, for you, again, you know, the first question was, you know, to see about how much we love South American football, et cetera, and all its turbulence. But again, you know, we did X amount of series of the Political Football Podcast. And again, you know, here in a single city, as you know, as Pete's just gone through there, there's so much political, literally political interference between politics and certainly football in Santiago.
Yeah, it's interesting that Pete says about Colo-Colo and, you know, how it's linked with Pinochet, which you think, you know, almost, you know, I'm sort of, my barrier's up against it straight away. Then they said, well, they just actually also linked with Allende before that. And it's a bit like Real Madrid, who are sort of often tainted with being Franco's club, but you know they weren't really until they became very successful. And he just wrapped himself around the success of a Spanish club because it was good for his sort of idea of Spain being great. Sport and politics, especially football and politics, do, as you say, you know, we've done God knows 50, 60 episodes on the political football, and it's one thing that's an eternal truth. It seems to be an eternal truth. Is that politicians like to associate themselves with successful football clubs. And it seems that, you know, in Santiago, regardless of whether you're left wing or right wing or whatever wing you are, it's no different, buddy. It's just no different, is it?
No. Like I say, we've done, there must be a back catalogue of, like you say, I don't know how many episodes where there's so many familiar stories and tales to tell. Stephen, again, something that we talk about, and it's a question that I often seem to level at you, and that's, you know, how football tends to reflect society and mirror society. But to me, it's, and football clubs are great at standing in isolation in terms of, not necessarily being neutral, but they stand in isolation as part of the community. But just occasionally, and as Pete's gone through there, when you have the complete appropriation of a club by someone like Pinochet, it almost seems cruel to the club and its fans and its community in terms of that almost disregard for the club and its fans to, you know, to completely appropriate it to yourself or your political ideals.
It's the opportunism of it all as well, isn't it? It's kind of like, you know, this is the projection of Chilean greatness in the same way that Franco attached himself to Real Madrid. Here is this, you know, very handy projection of what that nation can do very, very well that's going to be seen, you know, across the continent, basically. So, yeah, you know, it's a shame, but it's just the way football tends to be, because it is the sport of the people. It's, you know, it is the global sport. It's a massive amplifier for people like Pinochet, for people like Franco. You know, we only have to look at, you know, British Prime Minister tipping up to watch Southampton get relegated. You know, what's sorry, Pete. Sorry, Pete.
Ouch. He's really not sorry.
Your gang of absolute Tories. I know you're not. But yeah, no, this is, you know, it's just that photo opportunity, isn't it? It's that complete, here I am associated to something that the people love. Look at me, down with the people. I am one of you.
I don't know what to say. I'm trying not to look at anything on the screen. Excellent, Stephen. It's been a while since you offended anyone, so well done.
It's always edgy, these ones. Do you feel like kind of like you can dislocate people's knees and all
that? Absolutely.
On the top of the ball.
It really did a hatchet
I've taken Pete out of the hip with that one, I think.
The worst thing is I didn't even see it coming with the question. It was a complete blindside.
I don't think anyone saw Sunak coming to the St Mary's for that particular game. It's like, yeah, pick a team when you're basically going to go down. It's so symbolic. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, it's like, I know David Cameron kind of like mixing up West Ham and Aston Villa and all that type of crap. I'm sure there's a myriad of examples of other coloured political parties with exactly the same type of scenario. But it's always worse when it's the wrong ones.
We'll take a break. A message from our sponsor. We'll move on now to something a bit more cheerful and a bit happier. Let's talk about silverware. Obviously, Pete, Gary alluded to a little bit of success with some of the clubs, but in terms of taking us back through, and again, this is always something that fascinates me, is where these clubs sit domestically in terms of domestic honours and domination and periods of success. But for me, it's always about continental success as a real indicator of where they sit as a football superpower at any particular time.
Yeah, so I think if we look domestically, if we go from kind of 1933, which is when the professional league start, it's basically dominated by Colo-Colo. 33 league wins. The next most is Universidad de Chile with 18, Católica with 16. There's been a few others. Unión Española's won 7, Audax Italiano 4, Palestino a couple. Magallanes won 4, but way back in the 1930s. Although it's great to see them back in the Premier League in the kind of first division again. That's one of my favourite stories of Magallanes returning to the first division. Actually getting in the Libertadores this year as well, although they lost in the second round, which is a bit of a disappointment. In terms of the Libertadores, there's been 4 Chilean teams that have made the final. 3 of them come from Santiago. Colo-Colo, as you'd imagine, they were runners-up in 1973. Like I said, that was a really important year for Chile. That's the year of the coup. I'm going to talk about that hopefully a bit later when we come to big games. But that a lot of the Chilean players were interviewed for a particular documentary about that cup run. And it's a great documentary. Talk about the fact that they think that they managed to forestall the coup by actually doing very well. Then lots of ways, the only thing that was holding Chile together in the very turbulent 1973 was the fact that their Colo-Colo were doing really well in the Copa Libertadores until they lost to Independiente in the final. Unión Española made it to the final in 1975, again lost to Independiente, who were the kind of executioners of Chilean clubs and pretty much everyone else in that particular period of time. Católica, as we've mentioned before, made it to the final in 1993. They've got to semi-finals in 4 of the times, in 62, 66 and 69. But then the only team that's won it was Colo-Colo in 1991. And again, this is an incredibly significant political time. This is only a couple of years after Pinochet, again, the dictator, managed to lose a plebiscite. And this is actually something I wrote my university dissertation on back on the days. How does it take the dictator manage to lose a plebiscite that he is in charge of, that he has all the kind of the economy, the control of the media, everything else, fear and everything else? Somehow Pinochet loses this plebiscite. There's a great film about it called No, which I encourage everyone to watch. But anyway, only a couple of years later, with this new excitement about being a democracy and the kind of return to elections and the ridding of Pinochet, Colo-Colo again become important for the nation by winning the Libertadores in 1991. And again, Patricio Aylwin, the president at the time, again uses Colo-Colo to try to unite the nation. So again, once again, Colo-Colo becomes this vessel of a club that represent all Chileans. And they're a club that do this. They very much talk to themselves about being the club of the rich, the club of the poor, and they're owned by the rich, without any doubt about it. But they're very good at marketing themselves as the club of the nation. And once again, they're used with this particular triumph in 1991 to be the club of the nation by the new president who has replaced Pinochet, obviously. The other major tournament to talk about is in 2011 with Universidad de Chile, La U, as they're known, the U. They beat LDU Quito in the final of the Copa Sudamericana, the kind of the the second tier South American Championship. They win it in 2011. They beat them Quito 4-0 on aggregate. Eduardo Vargas, one of the players who a lot of Chileans regard as the guy that should have made it really big but didn't, was top scorer in that particular year. And they actually beat some pretty big clubs on the way up. They beat Vasco da Gama. They beat Flamengo. They beat Arsenal. He probably bottled it. It was the Arsenal from Argentina, obviously.
Oh, wow, they're all coming out now.
I tend to have a pop at them.
And then I've started something there.
You really have.
Arsenal of London just signed off.
It's delicious to do it, isn't it? And they beat Nacional as well. So that was a proper Copa Sudamericana kind of win. It wasn't just kind of second-tier teams that they beat. There were some real giants on the way. So there's only been two Continental League two continental trophies won, but both of them were really big in their own way and at particularly important political times.
Well, I did have a question for Gary, but then just as I was writing it down, you threw out the Arsenal comment and I stopped writing. Oh, wow. Okay, so Gary, my question was, although I haven't really formulated it properly in my head now, but, you know, we talk about the importance, I talk about the importance of continental success. And you won't be able to answer this question, but I'm going to give you it anyway because I want to hear what you think. In terms of South American players, footballers, do you think they prize the move to Europe more than they do the continental silverware from their own continent?
I guess it depends what criteria you're judging by. If you're judging by glory, shall we say, then, you know, if you're judging by financial, then yeah. I mean, it's interesting, you know, Pete mentioned about, you know, Colo-Colo and... when they had that success in the 90s, they had a Croatian coach, a guy called Mirko Jovic, and they won the title 2 years on the bounce, and they beat Olympia 3-0 to get to the first team to win the Copa Libertadores. And then they went on from there, and they lost the Intercontinental Final to Red Star Belgrade. So that was a great run. And so, I mean, you know, Chilean players of that club must take massive pride from there. But, you know... This difference between winning a trophy sometimes and not winning a trophy is very small. And, you know, go to Universidad de Chile, and they got to the semi-finals of the Copa Libertadores four times and lost each time, and 1796, 2010, 2012. So they were so close to glory, and you wonder if one of those teams had been more successful, so one of those campaigns had been more successful, would the transfer fees and the wage they could command in Europe been far more than they would have been for being losing semi-finals or losing finalists. It's just interesting sort of to compare how the difference between, you know, the perception of value can be so determined by such a thin line.
And like I say, it's always something that interests me and fascinates me. Continental success and where players sort of what value they place on it. Like you said, depending on whether you identify glory through financial gain or whatever, or notoriety or whatever it is. But for you, Stephen, your question, which is quite similar to Gary's, really, in that, you know, we talk about, you know, we've gone through these and a lot of, you know, we've hit cities where there's been major Copa Libertadores winners. And I suppose this question could apply to Europe as well, in the Champions League and the European Cup. But do you think either clubs of certain countries have, not say a more winning mentality, but have, when it comes to the really big continental cup finals, a team from Brazil will always, or Argentina maybe, have a stronger mentality in those big, big games than maybe clubs from the less successful nations in South America?
It's a combination of the mentality that they have and the psychological hold that they have over the opponents. Because, you know, there'll be certain games where, now, a Chilean team will take to a pitch against an Argentinian team or a Brazilian team. They beat before they kick the ball, you know, and that's the same, exactly the same in Europe when, you know, a top English club or a, you know, Spanish club, you know, goes up against a team from even France, for instance, who have such a pitiful record, you know, in European club competition for the state that they're in, for the nation they are, the talent that they've produced, and the fine clubs that they've had over the years, you know, something somewhere in the psyche stops them from attaining. So for Santiago to supply three teams that have reached Libertadores final is pretty stunning, really. You know, and then an extra one that's won the Sudamericana without reaching a Libertadores final. it shouldn't be undersold that, you know, here is a city of immense substance that kind of bucks that trend a little bit. Yeah, Colo-Colo have had the only one success. But when you're talking about, you know, Unión Española reaching the final in 75, you know, granted at a high point in the history, you know, the golden years, literally the 1970s, there's an eye of the storm there, you know, where they are, you know, as magical as Colo-Colo are. So yeah, you know, to go back to the question, it is a combination of the mentality of the Brazilian or the Argentinian side who have that track record and expectation of victory, but also the psychology of the underdog in believing that they can overcome them or not.
It's, I mean, Pete, I'm not, you know, I don't know how, you know, you've lived there, I suppose, you know, compared to the three of us, I suppose you have firsthand experience. You've lived it. I'm assuming you've lived through campaigns of Copa Libertadores campaigns and seen the impact and effect that it has on the people there. But, you know, like we've just been talking about there, either in terms of mentality, in terms of perception of continental glory, you know, what did you witness in terms of the perceptions of it?
Yeah, so I was there in a really big year. I was there in 1998, which was the World Cup year. That was the Zamorano and Salas World Cup year, where Chile kind of returned to the fold. You know, if you remember the Condor Roberto Rojas had earned Chile bannings from the two World Cups because he feigned injury against Brazil in a really key moment. There's a brilliant article, again, by Diego Vilches, who I returned quite a lot to. He's one of the kind of foremost experts on Chilean football, academically anyway, who talks about how, you know, there was this kind of long period of feeling that they were inferior. Like Stevie said, we've talked about jerarquía. Hierarchy is a massively important comment and concept in South American football. Chile did not fear themselves to be in the top hierarchy of South American football. It goes all the way back to the 1920s or 1910s when Chile first participated in the South American Championships. And they are visibly behind the development of football in Argentina, in Uruguay, even in Brazil. And they feel themselves inferior, and this embeds themselves. One of the first kind of fathers the real father of Chilean football, a guy called David Arellano, who is, you know, hugely important for the professionalization of Chilean football in 1920, sees themselves as being behind everyone else and tries to bring them up to date. But this kind of thing is embedded, and it goes all the way through 1962, when they're bidding for the World Cup, they say, you know, we need to have the World Cup because we have nothing else, which again is not a kind of, you know, the statement of a nation that is kind of presenting itself well. And again, in the 1963, 1974 World Cup, there is very little expectation that little Chile are going to go to the 74 World Cup and doing well. There is a mentality of failure. Now, one of the things that Pinochet does do in all the awful, terrible things that he does in terms of human rights abuses, he does instill an idea of Chile as a developing nation that has a sense of worth and a sense of pride and a sense of faith in its own abilities, which starts to translate in growing confidence on an international level. And again, in lots of ways, this the epitome of this was Chile potentially going to be qualifying for the 1990 World Cup. This is what Diego Vilches argues, that this is the kind of, there is a period where Chilean football does believe it can compete, does believe it can do well on a kind of national level. Colo-Colo are the example of this. And Roberto Rojas, you know, by his actions in the Brazil game, by pretending to be hit by that kind of the flare that's chucked from the crowd, cutting himself, almost kind of undermines that totally. It's kind of like a real hammer blow to the Chilean psyche. But it does build on this kind of lack of hierarchy. And that is really only finally overturned in lots of ways, almost finally, when you have this golden generation of lots of, you know, of players who came up with some of the big Santiago clubs in the 2000s to win the 2015 and 2016, I think it was, Copa America. You know, suddenly this is almost the first time that Chile has achieved this. But for a long, long time, there has been this sense of inferiority, of we're not quite as good as the big nations, you know. So yeah, I think there is that kind of expectation of struggle. And I think another aspect of that is that a lot of Chilean players didn't go to Europe for a long time. If you look at some of the greatest Chilean players of the 70s, 80s, 90s, they go to Mexico or they go to Brazil, but they don't really make it to Europe as much. That's why Zamorano is so important and Salas is so important, because they make it in Europe. But there aren't very many of examples of that beforehand. I think that also contributes to the sense of our players aren't doing it on a very, very biggest level. You know, I think that's part of it.
Thanks, guys, for answering my questions that I have while I'm sat here listening. It's always much appreciated. Okay, big game time. Gary, I think I'll come to you first. You can, if you want to talk us through your choice. I know there'll be more than one. Your choices, without being too presumptuous.
I only had one last week because, and then I sort of merged with Pete's, as Tommy did. So I picked two, but I said, I'm going to go for the second one.
Okay.
But then I had sort of the first one because I think the first one's a bit of a tragic story, referring to the guy that Pete mentioned earlier, David Aviano, who was the Colo-Colo stadium was named after, but perhaps we might come back to that afterwards. But I'm going to back to the first time when a non-CONMEBOL club won the Copa Sudamericana. And this goes 2006 with a two-leg final, played in November, December. Teams taking part were Colo-Colo and Pachuca. The first leg played in Pachuca resulted in 1-1 draw. Second leg in Santiago was won 2-1 by Pachuca, making them the cup winners for the first time. That's interesting. It doesn't sound very interesting, but Pachuca from Mexico, and they're not a member. They're a member of CONCACAF, not CONMEBOL. And they, so strictly speaking, they shouldn't have qualified. But they were deemed to be eligible to complete the tournament after winning the 2006 Mexico Primera División. And they were invited by CONMEBOL to take an automatic berth in the knockout stages. And Pachuca's victory in the final marked the first time in history that a representative of CONCACAF had won a CONMEBOL-sanctioned tournament.
Well, that's not where I thought you were going there, Gary. That's excellent. That's a great choice.
Okay.
Well done, you. Yeah, yeah. I love that choice. Well done. Stephen, we'll come to you next.
I mean, it's got to be the 91 Copa Libertadores for Colo-Colo. It's the obvious choice, but it's the biggest achievement from any club in Santiago, you know, to finally crack the code. And it's there is a bit of kind of, I don't know, there's that, I don't know, hierarchy in a way that Pete speaks of, even within this. Is that, you know, it's a success that comes under Yugoslav coach rather than a Chilean coach. The goalkeeper's Argentinian. Well, you know, the playmaker up front is Argentinian. The player who scores two goals, you know, in the final, you know, he's on loan from one of the big city rivals. You know, there's a little bit of the kind of like the cobbled together almost. It's kind of like, you know, they win it in spite of themselves in a manner. You know, it's Olympia are the opponents. So yeah, you know, it's almost like they trip over their own feet. They win it 3-0 on aggregate in the end. You know, the second games were 3-0 win. But you know, there's elements to it that makes you think how did you even get there? You know, the shirts are even sponsored by Lada. You know, it's a car that should not have reached its destination, yet it did.
It really is cobbled together. When we go back to the cut and shut of Chilean football, though, we've gone complete circle. Pete, for you, your chosen game.
I mean, I was tempted to go with some games from the Santiago Morning 1939 season when they beat Católica 8-2, they beat Green Cross 7-5, they beat Magallanes 6-5, they beat Metropolitano 7-1. But I actually want to talk about, again, the 73 Colo-Colo Libertadores campaign, because it's such a crucial and it's such a big political moment for the country. And this all came from a documentary that I watched called Sabor a Victoria, Taste of Victory, which chronicles it. But it doesn't just say, here are the games, here's the people scoring goals, here's the people talking about the goals. It shows what's going on in Chile at the time. It really reminded me of another documentary, a really important third cinema film called Battle for Chile, made by people who were exiled by the Pinochet dictatorship, who made this film in three parts about all the terrible things that were going on in Chile and how Pinochet and the right were kind of bringing down the Allende dictatorship. So that's one film that I'd seen. But I watched this documentary and it's all about what's going on in Chile, but also what the football team are doing to kind of to calm the passions when everything is really kicking off. There are strikes, there are protests, there are, you know, rumours of a coup at any moment. And meanwhile, Colo-Colo are progressing their way through the Libertadores campaign for the first time, beating various teams. So, you know, Colo-Colo have a great team. They have a guy called Chamaco Valdez, Francisco Chamaco Valdez. They have a really famous footballer called Carlos Casilli, who I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later on. But anyway, so Colo Colo make their way through the kind of various rounds. They beat Unión Española. They beat Nacional, the Ecuadorian one, not one of the good Nacionals of Uruguay or Colombia, you know, the sub Nacional, if you like. But then eventually they come to Botafogo and they manage to beat them. They beat them, you know, 2-1 in Rio, which is a massive moment, you know. And again, there's a report on the newspaper that the whole of Chile are following this. And the newspaper headline is, "We sang from the whole of Arica," which is the very far north of Chile, "all the way down to Magallanes," which is the kind of the bit in the kind of Patagonia region. And again, Chile is a very long country. So that's a lot of singing that's going on. But it gives you an idea of the kind of the national pride that is achieved by beating Botafogo. They do lose 5-1 to Cerro Porteño from Paraguay, but then they beat them 4-0 at home. And then they draw 3-3 again with Botafogo that secures the qualification. And what's going on through this is signs of the political protest. Abel Salvador Allende taking these players to the presidential palace, say, look at what Chile can do. Look at how Carlos Casali is scoring these goals. Look how good Chamaco Valdez is. And it becomes this national moment of the whole of the country almost trying to forget about what's going on politically, all the turmoil at home, and suddenly finding pride in this football team. And again, there's various really interesting moments. There's a couple of the footballers of that team who say that they actually thought about bribing the refs in the semi-final and final because they didn't think they had a chance of winning. They knew that the teams against them, you know, whether it was Independiente, were probably going to be bribing the ref. And they said the same thing. They said, "We thought about paying him $1,000 because he was staying in the same hotel as us. But then the club chairman said, no, we can't do it. We need to win this in the true way." And of course they don't. There is a dodgy penalty. There is a kind of the Paraguayan ref apparently gives a goal that really gives a penalty that it never should have counted. And eventually they end up losing to Independiente in the third kind of the game. But what comes across to the whole of this run is just what a big deal this is for the whole country and how much people like Casali and Valdez and the manager and various other players thinking, we are playing for the nation here. And Carlos Casali actually says that he thinks that it's the only thing that was keeping Chile at the time. And it was probably the only reason why that the coup didn't happen until September that year. It could easily have happened any time before that. But the times weren't right because there was just enough support for Allende or there was just enough pride in the country of what was happening to make them forget some of the bad things that were going on. So I think politically, that's the biggest game the biggest series of games that Chilean history has had footballistically.
Great, great answer, Pete. Great answer. Okay, we'll come to players and managers. Obviously, with you know, there's been the odd brief mention in terms of games and things like that. Oh, let's see, Pete. You can start. No, we'll come to you last because you'll have all the, as I call them, the old one-legged pirates that turned out. And I do like to hear about them. Gary, we'll come to you first.
Players or coaches or both.
It's your series. You're the curator. You were late. You can decide.
We'll start with Colo Colo because that's obviously the big team. And so some famous names: Alexis Sanchez, Arturo Vidal, Zamorano, Mark Gonzalez, Claudio Bravo, Carlos Casale, as Peach just mentioned, and the Robledo brothers who played at Newcastle as well before going back to Chile to play for Colo Colo, a lady called Claudia Martinelli, who's probably known as the best goalkeeper in the world in female football, plays for Paris Saint-Germain. Moving on to coaches I've mentioned at Colo Colo, Mirko Zovic, obviously has been massively successful there, and Ferenc Puskas coached for a while. Players at Deportivo Universidad de Catalunya. Some names that will sort of ring bells in Premier League football or Championship football. Jean Beausejour played at Birmingham and Wigan. He came through the youth academy at Deportivo Universidad Catalunya. Ruben Espinosa has got an interesting history. He was with the university club for 10 years and moved to Colo Colo and won the Libertadores and then played for 20 games at Everton on loan. Javier Marquez, who played for West Ham for 24 games on loan. There's a great story about an American goalkeeper called Johnny Walker, which has got nothing to do with the whiskey, of course, who signed for University of Catalunya, and they loaned him out, and then he came back afterwards But from 1997 to 2002, he broke the record for the newest records for Universidad Católica. When they finished up as the champion, he won the championship. In 2001, received the Chilean Goalkeeper of the Year award, and he had a club record of going 708 minutes. That's almost 9 complete games without conceding a goal. Interesting character there. Going on to Universidad, Manuel Pellegrini played for them and also coached them. Mauricio Pellegrino, briefly at Peach Club at Southampton, was coached there. Jorge Sampaoli, who is a much troubled coach in Southern Europe and South America, he recently left Seville, is now Flamenco, which is his 24th appointment in 29 years. That's 24 appointments in 29 years. I'm not sure that's a great recommendation or not, but there you go. And they also had a guy called Fred Wood, who coached them as well. Alonso Zuniga, he didn't make it at Universidad Católica, but in a strange move, in 2005, he spent one season in Liechtenstein with Verduf. It was the only time he played outside South America. He played 8 games and won the Liechtenstein Cup, beating USV Eschen 4-1 in front of 1,050 people, and then moved back to Chile. I mean, I just amazed. Just a couple briefly with Santiago Morning. Unless I've missed this guy, I must go back. I've missed him. I have missed him. I'm going to go back in a second. Juan Antonio Pizzi, who played for Barcelona, was a coach at Santiago Morning. But Wim Roysbergen, who played in the 1974 World Cup final, was a youth team coach. I think it was at Universidad, and then coached the full team for 2 years as well afterwards.
That's not a bad list, Gary, to be fair.
Not bad.
No, not bad. Not bad at all. Stephen, any Chilean players ever played at Anfield? Because for somehow you always seem to be able to throw out a reference to a random 18-year-old Chilean trialist who once turned out at an away game at Peterborough or something like that.
Mark Gonzalez.
Mark Gonzalez for a while, yeah.
There we go.
What we did with Mark Gonzalez is we fought tooth and nail to get him a work permit. Failed a couple of times. Finally got him a work permit. He made his debut. I think he scored or he hit the post in I think it was a Champions League final qualifier or something. I think he scored. And it was a fantastic goal as well. And finally, you know, we looked like up and running. But then injuries took hold, and I think we had to send him off on loan to Albacete before we could get a work permit for him or something like that. And he looked a world beater, and then came to Anfield and just face planted basically after a wonderful debut. Away from Anfield's finest Chilean that never quite was. I mean, you can't go any further than, any higher than Ivan Zamorano. You know, you have to give him the big up. No, Pete's mentioned him. But to be such a star for Real Madrid and Inter, it's understandable why he holds such a thrall over Chilean football. There are so many to pick. I mean, Lionel Sanchez is one. He scored goals for fun, not even as a focal forward. He had a track record of, a goal every other game. I think, for Universidad de Chile, had a little bit Cruyff in the way that he went and had his final season with Colo Colo and won the title. Bit like when Cruyff goes to Feyenoord from Ajax, he falls out with them, they won't give him the extra year. He was part of the Chile side that made the semi-finals of their own World Cup in 62. On the touchline, Luis Santibanez, who was the guiding light for Espanola, in that magical run in the 70s. He walked away from the club, came back again. Santiago offers, a lot more than, you scratch below the surface and find that there's some, stunning individuals there.
Great work, Stephen and Gary. Great research, guys. Pete, you're going to have to scratch now and see who we can really now find who set Chilean football alive.
Oh, don't forget Carlos Casali as well. And Pete mentioned him before as well. Magnificent player who we had a short spell at Barcelona as well, and was magical despite looking like a taxi driver.
Here's. I should have said that 1973 Colo Colo team were known in Argentina as the Equipo de los Gorditos, the team of the fat little guys. because Carlos Casali and various other people in that team were not athletic looking. They were quite short, they were quite stocky, they were quite chubby, and Casali was very foremost in amongst those. So yeah,
very good. I mean, he was part of that 1982 World Cup squad as well. That, I mean, I always remember kind of like that. What always stuck out about the Chile page of that was that virtually every player seemed to be playing for Coca-Cola. Ultimately, when I've come to that, you know, they had eight in the squad when push came to shove. I'd imagine that those Panini albums were printed 6 months before the World Cup. You know, they probably did put 16 Coca-Cola players on that page. But, you know, the telling thing was that 21 of Chile's 22 in 1982 were playing their football at that point in time in Santiago. It's unreal.
Great fact. Well done. Anyone left for you, Pete, or have we exhausted that list?
Oh, I got loads for you. I mean, Casali also, we should remember that he got sent off in the 1974 World Cup. You know, he was there as well and managed to get sent off. He missed a penalty in 1982. Casali is an absolute hero to the left in Chile because he is famous for ignoring a Pinochet handshake when they were being introduced to him at the Presidential Palace. He also very famously wore a red tie, and Pinochet said that he didn't like that colour. So he was a man that stood up for what he believed in. He also very famously appeared in a TV advert for during the plebiscite year that Pinochet lost. It was actually his mother. His mother was tortured and arrested by Pinochet in 1973. And she is the woman that is seen talking about her experiences and why people should vote against him. And right at the end of the video, Carlos Casali, you know, turns up to say, "This is my mother, and I kind of support her." So he's kind of got this fame for being a real left-wing footballer. There's a stadium, I think, at Colo-Colo for him now. And actually, two other players that are very associated with very brave acts in 1973 were Leonardo Vélez, who, again, was a star of that particular team. And he went along to the Estadio Nacional, the national team stadium, after the coup, because a lot of the political prisoners were captured straight after the coup, were taken to the National Football Stadium and imprisoned there and tortured there and questioned there. And Vélez went along as soon as he found out what was going on and said, "Look, this is who I am. My uncle's here," and manages to free him, which is incredibly brave because he was also known as an Allende supporter and could easily have been captured and tortured. And someone else who did something similar was Francisco Chamaco Valdez, who I think is one of the leading scorers, or possibly was the leading scorer in the Chilean league and was part of the 73 team, who went along, I think he was the one that went along in his Colo-Colo shirt to prove who he was, to ensure that Hugo Lede, who was a figure of the 1962 World Cup, was freed from Estadio Nacional, who again had been captured due to left-wing sympathy. So he went and says, "No, there's no way we can imprison this particular guy. He was a hero of 62. We've got to get him freed." So there's a couple of guys who were incredibly brave, aside from their football kind of exploits. Going back to one of the first figures of Chilean football who we've mentioned, I think it's worth discussing David Arellano. So he is a player for Magallanes to start with, but he thinks that Chilean football is not professional, it's not developing, it's not training properly. And he is the guy that causes the split from Magallanes to say, we can't just see it as a hobby, we can't just see it as a leisure activity, we need to professionalise this. So there's a split at Magallanes, Colo-Colo is formed, David Arellano becomes the figure of this new team and a figure of this kind of professionalised football. And he is the leading scorer of a Copa Sudamericana, the South American Championship as it was at the time for Chile, so he becomes a hero there. But then they do this tour of Europe and tragically he is kicked in the stomach in a game against a team in Valladolid and dies the next day from peritonitis. And this is a national tragedy on every single Chilean newspaper. When people find out, this becomes the lead story. So you have this hero of Chilean football, the guy that was the founding father of professionalisation, leading scorer, hero of Colo-Colo, the team of the people, you know, the constructed team of the people, who dies tragically in this game. So he's the kind of the lost hero. So this is why he becomes kind of the centre of Colo-Colo's identity in lots of ways, to the extent that there's a black stripe across the badge and sometimes the shirts, which represents still the death of David Arellano back in something like 1927, I think it is, somewhere around there. Yeah, so, you know, hugely important figure. A couple of other players, there's so many stories, but a couple of other quick players. We could talk about Sergio Livingston, the first great Chilean goalkeeper. He was known as the Toad. Played in various World Cups in the 1950s, but again seen as being Chile's first great goalkeeper. Just love the name, you know, Sergio Livingston. Love the nickname, the Toad. Católica also had a guy called Alberto Fuyu, who was very well known for scoring a crucial goal to get a kind of trophy for Católica against, I think it was Universidad de Chile, became a bit of a hero. There are so many players of the 1962 World Cup that come from Universidad de Chile. Leonel Sanchez is the most famous of them. He was named as the third hardest footballer of all time, pretty much because he broke Humberto Maciel's nose in the famous Battle of Santiago game. He also knocked out Mario David, and he did it without getting sent off as well. So proper hard man. And he was a winger or a left midfielder. So he wasn't even your archetypal hard man centre defender. He was a kind of attacking midfielder. Absolute legend of the Universidad de Chile team, alongside people like Pedro Araya, Luis Musri, who were players of this kind of blue ballet team of the 1960s of Universidad de Chile. Unión Española have a couple of very famous Basque players like Juan Legarreta and Isidro Langara, who were very important in Spain when they played for the Basque teams and then left Spain because of Franco and then ended up in Chile and Mexico, still representing Spanishness but taking on kind of positions in Chilean football. Again, there's loads of others. The last one I'll talk about, I think, because there's so many, is a guy called Raul Toro, who played for Santiago Morning, again, a team that we've talked about a lot as possibly being our favourite team in lots of ways. Anyway, Raul Toro is the hero of the 1942 Santiago Morning league-winning season. Slightly dodgy character in terms of reliability. Very popular due to his bohemian lifestyle. Apparently, quite often, Santiago Morning and Santiago Wanderers, which is not a team in Santiago, a team in Valparaiso, used to play with 10 players for quite a while into the game until he actually turned up at the game, having been on a night out. Apparently, sometimes he was actually locked in a police cell the night before a game because it was the only way that the coach knew where he was going to be before a game starts. So quite a figure, but also kind of did it when it really matters most in 1942, arguably Santiago Morning's greatest ever league triumph, probably only one as well, I think it was. So there's lots of other great characters, but yeah, I'll leave it there, I think.
The game that Pete mentioned there with David Arellano was the second game I was going to mention, but I'm glad Pete covered it anyway, because apparently he was the prime figure in organising Colo-Colo to go to Europe. He was the first Chilean team to tour Europe. And, you know, this guy, he was obviously a pioneer, as well as a great player, also a pioneer administrator, actually died. And the game was against Real Unión Deportiva in Valladolid. And what a tragic, I mean, such a tragedy for a guy who, you know, who sort of was a pioneer of Chilean football. I just sort of also chuck in, I found the Wim Rijsbergen reference, and it was Universidad Catalitica, who also had another couple of managers, interesting names. Gus Poyet was briefly coaching there, which many people remember. But there's a great guy who coached there between 1953 and 1954 with a glorious name of Billy Burnicle, who actually left there and took over to Halifax Town. Now, whether you take that as an upgrade or a downgrade, I'll leave you to decide, gentlemen.
Oh, brilliant. Just great knowledge, guys. Again, I can never decide which bit is my favourite part of this podcast. We've got to the stage where I ask you where you're gonna go if you get parachuted into maybe won't get parachuted into Santiago, but if you do, good luck with that, and hopefully you land somewhere safe. But anyway, imagine that everything's okay with the world. I'll start with you, Stephen, first. Where are you going to be watching your football in Santiago?
I think we are spoiled for choice here. I mean, if we could hop in the DeLorean, Green Cross would be well worth going watching.
With David Prowse up front.
With David Prowse up front. very much. We would cross the road to watch.
We would. Yeah.
But I mean, within that, you know, there was tragedy as well at play there as well. There's a football club that, you know, were ended in 1965, you know, 4 years after a tragic plane crash that killed the team. You know, out up in the mountains, and they were that so far wrong in their estimation of where this plane crashed that the wreckage wasn't found until 2015. You know, it was unreal, absolutely unreal. So yeah, historical terms, yeah, hop in the DeLorean, cross the road, David Prowse can help us. And very much like to go and retrospectively go and watch those. Santiago Morning are definitely on the list. You know, there is no discernible sash that appears in Santiago, which makes it very difficult to pick a team. But you know, they do have a little bit of the Brescia about them with that kind of like V, you know, on the shirts and stuff. But yeah, I'm gonna lean towards Espanola. I think they just have a bit of a hipster side to them. That 1970s side, you know, slightly bohemian. Santibanez went on to take Chile to the 82 World Cup as well. So, you know, he's got the 82 links. You know, it's got a little bit of everything there. So, yeah, just sort of push Espanola because I might not get up early enough to go and watch Santiago Morning.
Brilliant. You and the students all together. Gary, yourself, where would you be watching your football?
Well, I'm tempted by Union Española for obvious reasons because they've never been in Spain, but I'm going to Santiago Morning. I just think the club ticks all the boxes. So, yeah, I'm going to Santiago Morning, the Estadio Municipal de La Pantana. So that will be where I should be watching my football.
Ah, you see, that's the artist and poet in you, Gary. That's what that is.
Anybody wrote poetry, Stu? I told that to you in secret.
You did. I never said anything. I haven't told anyone. But yeah, you're right. Pete, for you, where would you watch? In fact, where did you? Oh, actually, first of all, did you go watch football while you were there?
Yeah, no, I did. I mean, I my first game was at Santiago Morning. And it was basically because...
Hey, well done!
Yeah, it's great. I mean, I just got taken to a proper ground straight away, or a proper team, you know. Basically because I was coaching sport in the Grange School, and one of the other coaches was a Santiago Morning fan, had the shirt. Immediately, obviously, I was entranced. I was a football fan. He took me along. It was great. They lost, you know. Can't remember even who it was.
Perfect.
Against. But you know, that was the game where it all started. So I was a morningista straight away. I was a micro bolsero from the very start. I mean, I love the idea of Magallanes. I love the fact that they've got back in the first division again after years out. But you know, they're a club of the elite. Not quite my thing. Nice kit though. But no, I'm along with Morning. There's a story I forgot about air crashes, which is never a great thing to say, but. There was a really, I don't know if you've seen Alive, the film about the plane crash of the Uruguayan rugby team that crashes in the Andes, and a few of the survivors are forced kind of into cannibalism when they survive. Now, this is a really kind of terrible story, but what it was the Uruguayan rugby team was going to go across to play Chile, or I can't remember if they played Chile already and they were going to go back. And actually, it's still something that's commemorated. While I was out there, I met some of the people that had survived that, and they have a dinner every year to survive it. But anyway, the football-related story is that one of the person who found some of the survivors was a shepherd from Chile called Sergio Catalan. He kind of was a shepherd and muleteer. He in a really isolated part of Chile. And when Colo-Colo were playing the deciding game against Independiente in the 73 final, in order to try and curry favour with the Uruguayans, to try and support Colo-Colo, they actually took Sergio Catalan with them to the game and made a big deal out of it. So, look, we're the team of Chile. Here's the guy that helped some of your rugby team survive after that terrible crash. So there's a kind of PR effort to try and, you know, gain support from the Uruguayan locals, hoping that in some way this would affect the end result of the game. I mean, this is the kind of extent that South American footballers will try to go to kind of, you know, win a game. I mean, not only was it, shall we blame the ref? I know, let's bring the guy that, you know, that helped these Uruguayan rugby players survive. That'll do it. So, yeah, I mean, it's a terrible story, but that guy became a bit of a celebrity. And I think he only died a couple of years ago. And that's what he was famous for, just being a shepherd who happened to find, you know, the survivors of that terrible plane crash. So, yeah. But anyway, going back to the story, Santiago Morning. Yeah, that's what I'm up.
I can't believe we've done what we have, an hour and 23 minutes. And Santiago Morning came up quite early. And it took us an hour and 20 minutes to find out you'd actually been there and watched that.
Yeah, I went to Católica and Universidad de Chile as well. But, you know, you always follow the first team you go to, don't you?
So. Oh, absolutely. Well, guys, what can I say? It's technically episode 14 of 14. Believe it or not, we've managed to record 14 episodes. I think that's the biggest surprise, actually, out of all of this, is that we've got through 14 episodes. I want to say we've no technical hitches, no lateness, no miscommunication, but that would be a lie. But anyway, it's taken us the best part of 3 years, but we've got through 14 episodes, and that's the important thing. Now, Gary, anything you want to add?
We have one to go. We have one to go, because this was jammed in as an extra one. And so I mentioned earlier that we'd flown across the Andes from the east of the continent to the west to get to Santiago, and we're going to fly back the other way. And if people were listening earlier to when we talked about when the Universidad Católica got to the Copa Libertadores final in 1993, the team they lost to is the name of the city we're going to be visiting in the last episode of the series. That's one new clue I'm going to give yourself, guys. If you're listening, you've got to go back and listen. If you weren't paying attention, you should have been, guys.
Wow. I can't believe you hide clues in the episode. I've never known you've done that before, Gary.
There's an absolute
another level of intrigue that you've just layered onto this podcast. Obviously, after Stephen's pure, unadulterated, unambiguous and fairly obvious brutality of other clubs, you're in there layering clues.
And dropping Easter eggs here and there, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow. It's like at the end of the Marvel films, if you stay right till the end of the credits, you get a little bit of a... I think it once people have listened to the music at the end of this podcast, I bet your voice pops up and we've never known. And your voice pops up at the end with a bit more of a... with a bit extra on this podcast that I've never
busted,
listened.
Busted.
Another 20 minutes while after we've gone.
Yeah.
On airports as well. He tells us all about all the other airports he hasn't told us about in the intro.
Well, now it's the South American airports, not the South American files, the South American airport files.
Well, like I say, we started off almost being introduced by Alan Wicker, and I feel like we've ended being introduced by Alan Wicker. So well done, Doc. Well done, Gary. A nice full circle of an episode.
Perfect.
So the good news is we're back for another episode. Who knows who'll turn up at what time, but that's all right. It's part of the fun, isn't it? See who turns up when. Always makes it more interesting, doesn't it, Gary? So we're back for one more. Gary's dropped clues all through this episode that you've just been listening to. So I want to say we'll see you there, but I have no idea where we're going.
just one final thing we're saying, Stu, that when we do this next episode, which is the end of the series, we'll also drop a trailer of what we're going to do next in the South American files as well.
Oh, wow. It's just brilliant. Do we need to know
I'll
anything?
I'll look forward to that because I've totally forgotten what it is we're going to do.
I was just thinking, are we supposed to know what that is?
So that'll be news for me, that one, as well as the listeners.
I'll tell you, it'll be fine. I'll tell you.
I'll tell you what, Pete, I hope you know, because if you don't know, it's going to be rubbish.
I think it's about South America. Is that a clue?
Oh, thank
he's
God.
Nailed it. The boy's nailed it.
Well done, because if it was just Stephen and I, we'd be, well, I don't know where we'd be.
Oh, I remember now. It's the closest clubs to each airport that Dan had mentioned.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I remember now. Yeah.
Which teams have colours that represent the livery of each South American airline?
Stop giving it all away.
So that should have whetted everybody's appetite. For next episode when Gary releases the official trailer, and we'll all find out what it is we're doing over the next few weeks, which is great. All that's left me to say is thanks, guys. As always, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time on the South America Files with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.